diplomatic traffic. The memo opened with a careful diffidence, full of caveats that were intended to batten down tight restraints on any reader's expectations. Any report at this time on the contents of traffic encrypted by the system, Meredith cautioned in his opening sentence, must necessarily be fragmentary and subject to correction in detail. And if that weren't warning enough that this was very much a work in progress, he offered yet another dose of candor. Only about 15% of the equivalences of the Soviet codebook are identified, some only tentatively. But once the qualifications were out of the way, his hesitancy vanished and the report rolled on with a compelling speed. Readers were rewarded with not merely theory or speculation about the enemy's tradecraft, but the real thing, an insider's tour of the KGB. Meredith had pulled a long list of cover names from the cable traffic. Some were used for locations. Others indicated either the senders or the recipients of the messages. And, most ominous, there were dozens of work names of Soviet penetration agents, living and breathing enemies buried deep in the nooks and crannies of American life. Still, the report offered lots of clues but no specifics. At that preliminary time, it was impossible to infer what sort of espionage activity these networks were conducting. The targets of specific KGB operations remained frustratingly beyond Meredith's grasp. Equally infuriating, the traitors were well protected by their cover identities. It was impossible to put a name or face to any of them. All that could be established was that they were out there, working in the shadows. Yet, in retrospect, one clue, although thin and stuttering, stands out. Years later, when events would give his report a riveting clarity, Meredith would recall what he had written with a shudder. Lib, Lieb, or possibly Liberal, was Antenko, Antenna, until 29 September 1944. Occurs 6 times, 22 October to 20 December 1944. Message of 27 November speaks of his wife Ethel, 29 years old, married, 5 years. Husband's work and the roles of Metro and Nil. But back then this was as far as Meredith's analysis could go. And after having stirred things up, after having as good as shouted its implicit warning that networks of Soviet spies were running pell-mell about the country, the report ended by taking a big, admonitory breath. In its present state, Meredith reminded his readers, the traffic tends to arouse curiosity more than it does to satisfy it. This unsatisfactory state of affairs makes it imperative this report be supplemented at intervals. Then, having said his piece, Meredith, quite happily, went back to work. As Meredith continued his daily struggle to make further inroads into the code, the Signal Corps spymasters at Arlington Hall pondered what to do with his report. They were suspicious by both nature and profession, and Meredith's findings had only reinforced their doubts. They no longer knew whom they could trust. But one thing, they felt, was a certainty. The larger the distribution list, the larger the chances the Soviets would learn what they were up to. They discussed sending a copy to the president, but this was quickly rejected. The White House, it had to be assumed, was riddled with Soviet spies. And the newly formed CIA? Its wartime predecessor, the OSS, had leaked too many valuable secrets. Why should things be any different merely because the initials had changed? After a good deal of heated debate, it was grudgingly decided to share a single copy, along with a few supporting pages containing the cryptic phrases and sentence fragments that Meredith had so far been able to extract, with the Army colonel running G2. But before they handed this package over, they made it clear that their concession was bound by a strict understanding. The documents would not leave his office at Military Intelligence. Colonel Harold Hayes agreed. The deputy chief of military intelligence, however, did not. Colonel Carter Clark thought the FBI might be able to help lift the masks concealing the faces in Meredith's report. On his orders, the memo and the challenging pages were hand-delivered by special military messenger to the Bureau's Washington headquarters. Pat Coyne, the head of the FBI Soviet espionage section, read the documents. There was a brief discussion with two of his deputies, but it was swiftly decided the clues were too slight and too fragmentary to be of any operational value. Satisfied, Coyne locked the papers in his office safe. 15. The safe was big, old, and battered, a Mosler with a spin-dial combination lock and a handle as long as a child's arm that you'd push down to open the creaking door. And every time Bob Lamphere went into Pat Coyne's office, he felt it pulling him like a magnet. He'd heard the stories, same as everyone else on the SE desk, how more than 5 months ago the Army Security Agency had sent over a top-secret report including a few pages of the cryptographer's work notes. Apparently they had made some inroads into a KGB code, but it had turned out to be just scraps of messages, sentence fragments really, and some cover names, nothing worth pursuing. And so the dull pages had been shoved into the espionage section chief's safe, and that was that. Still, Bob was curious. These days he had been shunted off to the side, assigned to monitoring the low-grade Soviet satellite states. And at home, things with Sarah had gotten off track, too. Often he found himself complaining about her drinking, and then she'd shoot back with digs at his hair-trigger temper, and they both knew the other had a point. Yet neither felt like changing. Neither felt like learning from past mistakes. They had moved out of the stuffy downtown apartment to a new development in Silver Spring, Maryland, which was probably a good thing. Now they had more space to hide from each other. So, perhaps, as Bob would later concede, he was just looking for something. He certainly had no specific sense of what was in the safe, nothing tangible that he could even hang a suspicion on. At best, Bob would hedge. He had an operational intuition. But whatever the reason, even before he'd read a single page that Meredith had written, he was intrigued. Every professional instinct he'd nurtured in the field, as well as all his unsatisfied ambitions, were shouting to him they held promise. Then one afternoon, Bob finally got up the nerve to confront Coyne. He might have been a prisoner approaching his jailer. The section chief, after all, was the boss who had locked him away in the backwater that was the satellite's desk. But Bob was no timid supplicant. His pitch was surprisingly blunt. It just wasn't in his nature to kowtow. "I'd like to take charge of the messages the ASA sent over. See what I can do with them," he said straight out. "Which I suppose means you're asking to be relieved of your present duty," Bob would remember Coyne shooting back. That led to some further sparring. But when Bob walked out of Coyne's office, it was with the agreement that he no longer had to put in any time monitoring the low-priority Soviet satellite countries. He had Meredith's pages clutched tightly in his hand. And he had Coyne's parting warning ringing in his head. "You have your chance, now you'd better deliver." Bob hurried to his desk to read the prize that had fueled his imagination. It didn't take him long. What he read, Bob judged as his heart sank, was not just thin, it was useless. He could not see how he, how anyone, could be able to make sense of these meager, incomprehensible scraps. Not for the first time in his roller coaster life, Bob wondered if he'd made a colossal, and this time perhaps career-ending, blunder. He'd gambled his professional future on the contents of the safe, and he'd lost. He lived with these wretched thoughts for the rest of the afternoon. On the commute back to Maryland that evening, still locked in this dismal mood, he decided to seek refuge in some dark bar. One scotch helped to level things off, and by the time he'd drained the second, his whole world had started to come back into focus. Now raised from the depths, he found the perspective he needed. All things considered, he told himself as his spirits rallied, he'd accomplished a very large victory that day. He was back to fighting the main threat, Soviet intelligence. That was the important thing, he felt. For how long had he been saying that it was every counterintelligence man's dream to be able to read the enemy's communications? Well, now he'd been given that very opportunity. True, the cards he'd been dealt were not very encouraging. The odds were stacked high against success. But, Bob reprimanded himself, he'd always been a battler. When had he ever backed away from a challenge? You don't grow up doing pick and shovel work in the bowels of a silver mine and expect things to be handed to you. Besides, what was the alternative? To rot doing the hack work on the satellite's desk? He decided. This was the bright, shining opportunity he'd been waiting for. He'd take those scant pages and do something with them. Over the next few days, as he sat in his distant corner in the sprawling SE section, his commitment grew into a plan of action. Bob realized, if he was going to assist the codebreakers in widening their narrow breakthrough into something more substantive, he'd need to meet with them. This, however, became a more complicated process than he had imagined. The FBI's bureaucratic fiefdoms were protected by vengeful lords, and Bob knew it would be a mistake not to pay them the homage they expected. Otherwise they'd make his life hell. So he sent off a request to meet with Wes Reynolds, the sleepy-eyed agent who was the Bureau's designated liaison to the ASA. According to headquarters protocol, Reynolds would need to make the initial contact with Frank Rowlett, the chief intelligence officer at the Signals Agency. Yet it must have been the busy time of year at Bureau headquarters, because a week passed before Reynolds could find the time to see him. When Bob was finally granted a face-to-face, their conversation was stiff but mercifully quick. A man who had more important things to get on with, Reynolds agreed to reach out to Rowlett and then briskly escorted Bob to the door. The meeting took place nearly 3 long weeks later, and it was, at Rowlett's insistence, on neutral ground. Bob, mystified but wise enough not to look for a fight, especially one he knew he wouldn't win, went as directed to the Pentagon. He entered a small, windowless room as clean as a surgical theater, just a metal desk, 2 straight-back chairs, and nothing else. Rowlett was a gruff, confident man who had no time for fools, yet even those who had felt the brunt of his disdain would concede that he'd earned the right to his arrogance. In 1930, Rowlett, barely 20, had been hired as one of the 3 civilian cryptanalysts at the fledgling Signals Intelligence Service, and over the subsequent decade, despite having no formal training, he'd been a key player on the team that had broken the Japanese code. Now he sat behind a desk in an office that Bob assumed had been borrowed for the occasion, and without any of the usual niceties, launched straight off into a lecture on security. Rowlett must have been aware that the man across from him was an experienced Soviet hand who held the rank of supervisor, yet he made no concessions. All Bob could do was listen and silently bristle. They were meeting off-site, Rowlett explained, because before Agent Lamphere could be allowed entry into the facility, a euphemism meant to suggest that even its name was classified, he had to agree to the ASA's rules. First, and this Rowlett made clear, was the holiest of holies. The attempt to break the Soviet code system was top secret. It could not be spoken about, nor could its existence even be hinted at. The other rules, all recited in Rowlett's rapid machine gun way, were stringent corollaries of the initial one. The FBI could not quote directly from a deciphered cable. The source of the paraphrased information could only be described as a highly sensitive source of known reliability. And the actual messages could only be shared with individuals who had a special top-secret clearance, regardless of the rank they held at the FBI. "Do you agree to all these conditions?" Rowlett demanded. Bob agreed. Nevertheless, as if he had not heard the response, Rowlett repeated his speech, rule after dogmatic rule. When he finished, he once again asked if Bob accepted the conditions. Growing weary of this game, Bob offered a curt yes. But this time Rowlett seemed satisfied, and so he moved on to new ground. "The man you'll need to work with is Meredith Gardner," Rowlett announced, according to Bob's vivid memory of the meeting. "He's unusual and brilliant. He speaks 6 or 7 languages, and is one of the few Western scholars who read Sanskrit." And in the prickly silence that followed, Bob couldn't help but complete Rowlett's thought. "While you, Agent Lamphere, are neither unusual nor brilliant." When Rowlett continued, he picked at the same sore spot. His words were another deliberate taunt. "You'll find Meredith Gardner to be a shy, introverted loner. You'll have a hard time getting to know him." Bob listened, but he was not about to let Rowlett's warnings throw him. Instead, he chose to focus on a more hopeful reality. The operation, his chance to do something of consequence, was moving forward. Besides, when had he ever met someone whom, when he put his cheery heart into it, he couldn't charm? A code-breaker stuck at his desk all day would probably be glad for a little company, some convivial conversation. The next morning, Bob headed off to Arlington Hall. The day was bright, and as he drove his bureau car into Virginia, his foot heavy on the pedal, the window cranked open so he could enjoy the breeze, he felt certain he was driving down the road that would take him back into the thick of things. 16. Bob was not surprised by the security, the barbed wire, the armed guards, the checking and rechecking of his credentials each time he entered another of the brick and wood frame buildings on the Arlington Hall campus. After Rowlett's harangue, he had anticipated finding things under tight control. But he had not been prepared for the legions of young women scurrying about. They seemed to be everywhere, walking about the grounds, striding officiously through the halls, poised over the long tables that served as communal desks. A secret female army hidden in the Virginia woods, he happily observed. As he made his way along the path that led from the main building, he took sly measure of one passing woman after another. A few, he noticed with a small ripple of vanity, openly stared back. On a different day he might have felt a stronger pull, contrived an excuse to dawdle, perhaps spark a conversation by asking for directions. But not this morning. His gaze remained alert, and he continued walking briskly to Building B. Meredith, in recognition of his accomplishments, and no doubt with a nod to security, now had his own office. Bob gave a knock on the door, waited for a response, and when there was none, he simply entered. The room was tiny and as dark as a cave. A man sat hunched over a wooden table that served as the desk, papers strewn all about, and he was so motionless that Bob's first thought was that he had caught him napping. His second thought, as he stepped closer, was that Rowlett's description had been altogether accurate. Gardner was tall and gangly, and when he finally raised his head to look up at Bob, his eyes were brimming with hostility. Meredith still hadn't spoken, and for an uneasy moment Bob wondered if he had been informed an FBI agent would be coming by. But then he remembered that he had been present the day before when Rowlett had called Gardner. It had been agreed, 10 a.m. sharp. So Bob decided to plow on. He introduced himself, then improvised a small speech about what an honor it was to work with Meredith, and how eager he was to do all he could to help. Bob believed he had a gift for hail-fellow intimacy, and he laid it on with thick, florid cheer. He was determined to win Meredith over. If Meredith had heard any of it, he gave no indication. Bob didn't retreat, but he didn't press either. Instead, more instinct than strategy, he offered his hand, and Meredith politely reached out and shook it. A small victory, Bob decided, and he swiftly tried to build on it. Without waiting to be asked, he brought the wooden chair that had been shoved against the wall up to the table and sat down opposite Meredith. Their eyes were now on the same level, and Bob felt they would be able to talk as one professional to another. He asked if Meredith had made any further progress on the codes. A moment passed in heavy silence. When Meredith finally spoke, the words came slowly and with great reluctance. "I don't think it's appropriate to discuss that." At least a dozen possible responses shot through Bob's mind, but none of them were polite. He waited until his rash mood had passed. Then he tried another tack. "How can I be of assistance to you?" he asked, hoping to sound both eager and considerate. Meredith once again appeared to give the question considerable thought, but whether that was really the case, or perhaps something else was going on in his mind, Bob could only guess. He found the man across from him inscrutable. "I don't know," Meredith announced an eternity later, or so it seemed to Bob. The words were flat, not plaintive, but neither were they dismissive. So Bob tried again. "I could mount a research effort to help you get information." Meredith nodded, but whether that meant yes or no was far from clear. Bob, though, soldiered on. "I could write up a memo about one of the message fragments. The FBI might have a glimmer of understanding on the subject matter being discussed by the KGB. Again, Meredith was noncommittal. Bob considered trying another approach, but Meredith had apparently lost interest. His eyes had returned to the papers on his desk, signaling that the dismal conversation was over. But Bob was determined not to betray his annoyed mood. He acted as if things had gone swimmingly. He told Meredith that it had been a pleasure to meet him and that he looked forward to their working together. "Think about my offer to help," he suggested, all the time feeling like some nagging salesman trying to close a deal. At the door, he announced that he'd return soon. "I look forward to continuing our chat," he lied. Meredith's head remained hovering over his papers. For all Bob knew, his thoughts were a million miles away. Bob walked back on the twisting, pebbled path leading back to his car. Unlike his earlier cross-campus trek, now he was too upset to pay attention to the people passing by. Worse, his anger had slid into despair. Yet Bob refused to give up. He returned to Arlington Hall a week later. "You give any thought to how I might be able to help?" he asked. Meredith looked past Bob toward the opposite wall, his eyes fixed on an invisible target. At last his gaze focused on Bob, and he offered a small shrug. When Bob left minutes later, he chose to remember that Meredith hadn't said no. He hadn't totally rejected the possibility of their working together. Another week, and again the same question. "You give any thought to how I might be able to help?" Bob asked. As he spoke, he tried not to sound too beseeching, as if he'd not abandoned all of his pride. Again the interminable silence. And then Meredith responded. He did not explain why he finally chose to answer. That would come later. Only in retrospect would Meredith reveal that at the time he had run out of alternatives. He had taken the deciphering as far as he could on his own. Stymied, with nothing to lose, Meredith had decided he might as well try anything, even the FBI. Was there any possibility, Meredith wondered, his words so hesitant they might as well have been dragged out of him, of obtaining the plain texts of Soviet cables? Perhaps traffic that had been transmitted from New York to Moscow, say, oh, in 1944? Bob understood the significance of the request. If Meredith had the before as well as the after, he could really go to town. The comparison of the same texts, one in Cyrillic and the other wrapped up tight in its blanket of encipherment, would be any codebreaker's dream come true. Give it to someone like Meredith and he'd tear the Soviet code apart. "Let me see what I can do," Bob responded, trying to appear confident. But even as he offered this small assurance, he knew it was hollow. In truth, he had no hope at all. The texts Meredith wanted were over 3 years old. How was the Bureau going to get their hands on them? Still, like Meredith, he was willing to give anything a try. When Bob returned to headquarters, he sent a flash request to the New York office. Need soonest plain text Soviet cables circa 1944. And while you're at it, he felt he might just as well have added, how about the key to the vault at Fort Knox? A thick package from New York arrived a few days later. It was sitting on top of Bob's desk when he came in. There was no accompanying note, nothing to hint at the contents other than the classified material stamp on the standard gray bureau envelope. Could it be? He ripped open the seal as eagerly as any child attacking the wrapping on a Christmas morning present. Inside were photographs of hundreds of cable messages from the Soviet Government Purchasing Commission on West 28th Street in Manhattan, all before they had been enciphered, and all had been transmitted to Moscow in 1944. How, he wondered, had the New York field office happened to have this pile of goodies sitting in its files? An SE colleague with whom he had worked surveillance details years ago on the streets of New York gave him an oblique answer. "There's no explanation," his buddy said carefully, "because officially these photographs don't exist. Get what I mean?" At once Bob did. They were the warrantless, forbidden fruits of a black bag job. Worthless, no, less than worthless, in any American courtroom. But the only judge Bob had to go before sat in a tiny room in a barracks-like building in Virginia. Later that day he presented the package to Meredith. Bob did not know if the photographs would prove helpful. Breaking a Soviet code, as Rowlett had pointed out in his superior way, required the sort of brain that belonged to someone else. All Bob said was that he hoped this was what Meredith had wanted. "Thank you," Meredith answered in his dead fish voice. Bob dropped the package on the desk and turned to leave. 2 weeks passed, and Bob had counted every day. But he had deliberately waited before returning. He wanted to give Meredith time to go through all the plain text messages. He could only begin to imagine the complexities of the trial-and-error process that would be Meredith's hunt for matches with the encoded cables. Also, Bob was in no hurry. He suspected his first chance could end up being his last one. If he had failed to provide the valuable information Meredith needed, he knew the codebreaker would never come to him for help again. Their partnership would have ended before it had truly started. It was with considerable trepidation that Bob entered Meredith's room. At once Meredith looked up from his pages. "We hit the jackpot," he said. His voice was still soft and hesitant. His posture as he sat at his desk remained so stiff and so self-contained that in someone else it would have been judged as downright antagonistic. But Bob didn't care. A single word, a word received as gratefully as any answered prayer, kept echoing in his mind. We. 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 We hit the jackpot. They sat and talked, and for all operational purposes it was their first conversation. Meredith was careful to avoid making any guarantees. The small accomplishments he did share were couched in his natural modesty. But despite these restraints, Meredith managed to reveal that he had made some real progress. His efforts to reconstruct the Russian codebook were beginning to pay off, and he acknowledged that the plain texts Bob had provided were invaluable. "Thank you," Meredith said. This time he was the one who offered his hand. When they shook, Bob felt the moment had its own deep solemnity, and a kinship had been forged. A week later, when Bob returned to Arlington Hall, he was greeted by what he immediately recognized as a different Meredith. It was not the reticent, inaccessible codebreaker of their initial encounters. Nor was it the man who, at their last meeting, had, in his guarded way, allowed himself a small victory lap. Meredith's mood today was something totally different, and for reasons he could not identify, it left Bob unnerved. "Look at this," Meredith finally got around to saying. He handed Bob a thin piece of paper. It was a deciphered cable sent from the New York KGB station to Moscow Center. The date was December 1944. Bob glanced at the cable, and as he did, he grew filled with alarm. He read, "Enumerates the following scientists who are working on the problem. Hans Bethe, Niels Bohr, Enrico Fermi." The list ran on for a total of 17 names. Each was a physicist, and each had worked on America's most closely guarded wartime secret, the construction of the atom bomb. Their identities, as well as their top-secret laboratories, had been so classified that they were only referenced even in U.S. government documents by their cover names. Yet the Soviets had penetrated the Manhattan Project. They knew who had directed the critical research and fabrication laboratories in the New Mexico desert at Los Alamos. They had the names of the scientists who had made the essential breakthroughs at the university centers of Berkeley, Chicago, and Columbia. They had the names of key scientific personnel at the massive Oak Ridge, Tennessee compound with its mile-long electromagnetic separation plants that provided the uranium-235 needed to make a bomb. It was at that moment that all Bob's professional suspicions, the sporadic drumbeats of clues he'd been collecting over the years, hardened into a new resolve. Any lingering doubts that it was a false peace, any attempts at denial, any bouts of indecision were cast permanently aside. "It became immediately obvious to me that the Russians had indeed stolen critical research from us," he recalled. At the same time, this clarity brought with it another profound conclusion. Bob was equally certain the Russians were still at it. And now, when he looked at Meredith, he was able to put a name on what the codebreaker had been feeling, because he felt it too. It was fear. 6 days later, on October 19, 1948, a meeting took place that made their partnership official. With Frank Rowlett and Colonel Hayes there to give the ASA's blessings, and a sullen Wes Reynolds representing the FBI, it was formally agreed that Agent Lamphere would work hand-in-hand with Mr. Gardner to exploit the deciphered Russian cable traffic. Then Bob and Meredith walked off together, returning to the dark little room in Building B, the light of battle shining in their eyes. Meanwhile, on the streets of New York, two old friends, each as committed to their cause as Bob and Meredith were to theirs, already had much to show for their collaboration. Alexander Feklazov, Sasha to his comrades, and Anatoly Yatskov, the two KGB handlers who had been running the Operation Enormos networks, had dispatched about 3,000 pages, according to the center's proud count, of stolen documents to Moscow. The flow of reports, a detailed how-to collection of diagrams, mathematical formulas, and atomic theory, had been so constant that their boss at the New York Residentura, Leonid Kovosnikov, became skeptical of the entire enterprise. A man whose suspicious mind ran to plots within plots, he feared that the haul might be too good to be true. He wondered if the foxy Americans had concocted a load of fake science with the aim of putting the Soviet physicists off the scent. His concern was understandable. "If this is disinformation, I'll send you off to the basement," Lavrenty Beria, the chairman of the new Special Committee on the Atomic Bomb, had threatened. And Kovosnikov, the old KGB hand, knew only too well that it was a journey from which you didn't return. But the product passed all the tests with flying colors. The team of scientists at Laboratory Number 2, the official report announced, had conducted the research and experiments necessary to confirm that the information provided by intelligence was true and not disinformation. And Igor Kurchatov, the young physicist directing the Russian bomb makers, went even further, nearly swooning with glee. "Wonderful materials. They fill in just what we are lacking." Formal notification was sent to the special committee. Laboratory Number 2 would proceed to construct a Soviet atomic bomb on the basis of materials received from the KGB. Part 2. In the Enemy's House. 17. They were now a team, huddled in Meredith's monk-like cell, an isolation that reinforced the realization that they were on battle footing. The two men began to search for a way to move forward. As in any new relationship, there was a tentativeness to their conversations, an elaborate politeness born out of caution, an unwillingness to offend. This awkwardness was further reinforced by the large differences in both demeanor and natural talents that shaped their approaches to the looming challenge, as well as to each other. But as they got to know each other, as each took appreciative measure of the other's unwavering commitment, what separated them began to recede. The contrasts became unimportant. Instead, they acquired an informed, increasingly respectful admiration for what the other had to offer. It was almost as if they each sized up the man across the room, one the prideful brawler and elbow-on-the-bar carouser, the other the devotee of unfathomable puzzles who hid behind an armor of social inhibition and wondered, "What if I could walk in his shoes? What if I could bring such gifts to my duties? Who knows what I'd accomplish?" In this curious way, a union of shared purpose was forged. There was no grumbling, no censorious judgment made by one partner of the other. Rather, these were extraordinary days. Working together, they filled the dismal space with an electric intensity. And in time, they did nothing less than recreate the KGB codebook. Bob would venture out into the real world of official Washington and track down the texts of documents, cables from Churchill to Truman, wartime notices, that had been transcribed with meticulous care in the KGB cables, and, like a hunting dog returning from the field, dropped these goodies on Meredith's crowded desk. Then he'd sit back and marvel at the alchemy. "I'd give him something," Bob would recall, "which was, say, the real text of something that was in his message, and that would give him a new word in his codebook. Right away he's over there with his pen writing it in there. He was as pleased as a little kid. One more word." In that workmanlike way, one valuable word at a time, there was a constant thrust toward tangible progress. Slowly the KGB codebook took fuller shape on Meredith's desk. And as this dictionary grew, as it provided more and more of the vocabulary they needed, they began to succeed in reading nearly complete texts of Moscow Center's cables that had been sent years earlier. The military intelligence generals, soldiers who had little if any hands-on experience with code-breaking, were astounded by this accomplishment. That a lone, and for that matter rather eccentric, bookbreaker and a plodding FBI agent had pulled off such a feat was nothing short of a wonder. Yet both Bob and Meredith knew better than to indulge in self-congratulatory outbursts. This was not the time. They had read the cable that hinted at the Russian penetration of the top-secret American project that built the atom bomb. They knew what was at stake. They understood the severity of the covert threat aimed against America. Grimly, Bob and Meredith weighed the significance of their accomplishment in strictly operational terms. They both realized they were stationed on the front lines in a secret war, and now they could launch their counterattack. "I stood in the vestibule of the enemy's house, having entered by stealth," Bob would later say, although such was their shared intensity of purpose that he could very well have been speaking for Meredith, too. "I held in my hand a set of keys. Each would fit one of the doors of the place and lead us, I hoped, to matters of importance to our country." They had, quite literally, filing cabinets full of clues. But at the same baffling time, they had no way of knowing which of Moscow Center's newly revealed twisting trails might lead to a mission involving the theft of atomic secrets, which led to other, still unimagined precincts of intrigue, and which ones, no less a possibility, led to an inconsequential dead end. The chase itself would be another mystery. Bob, the experienced field man, understood the complexity of what he was up against. "I had no idea where the corridors in the KGB's edifice would take us, or what we would find when we reached the end of the search," he conceded. Meredith, although a newcomer to the rough-and-tumble world of secret agents, shared this realization. "Their tactical predicament," he explained as he reached for another metaphor, "was like the old parable of the blind men and the elephant. Like the naive blind men who'd reach out to feel a tail or a tusk and think that that was all there was to the animal, they could grapple with a single Soviet cable and believe they were homing in on the enemy's main thrust. And yet this insight could be absurdly narrow. It might not reveal how their discovery fit into the entire operational puzzle that Moscow Center had assembled. More dangerous, it could just as well give them an entirely skewed view of what the enemy was up to. They'd be as mistaken as the blind men." And another profound anxiety. The clock had already been ticking away for years. Since the cables they were working with were several years old, they did not know if the enemy's spies were still active, operating at this very moment in the shadows, or if they had completed their missions. It was a very tricky business. There was really no choice, however, but to proceed. And no sooner had they addressed the task when Meredith, in a flurry of sustained activity, deciphered a series of apparently interconnected cables. His discovery was a further call to action. It had been Meredith's turn to deliver the goods. He had been working away for days, bleary-eyed, oblivious to Bob, maintaining the silence of the self-absorbed, and now he was finally done. There were no shouts of eureka, no attempts to coax a celebratory pat on the back from his partner. He simply handed the pages of his special study, as he'd officiously titled it, to Bob with a businesslike courtesy, knowing all the while that the words on the page were as potentially explosive as a ticking bomb. Bob read, "For some time, the cover name Enormos, which is not a word found in the Russian dictionaries, but is obviously based on the English enormous, has been known to occur in one or two New York-Moscow messages of 1944 in the system, but previously the context has not been readable enough to limit the possible reference of the name. Recently, enough context has been recovered to suggest a possible link between Enormos and wartime nuclear fission research. So there it was. The translation of four still rather cryptic cables filled out this study, and each one reinforced Meredith's deduction that Enormos was Moscow Center's cover name for its plot to steal atomic secrets. Now that Bob's worst fears had been confirmed, he was less surprised than appalled. How could the nation have allowed itself to be so easily victimized? And was it too late? Could his efforts hope to be something more than an after-the-fact closing of the barn door? Or were the Enormos spies still at work, having moved on from pilfering the science of the atom bomb to the secrets of the next super-weapon, the hydrogen bomb that Bob had heard mentioned in deliberately vague references in several Bureau counterintelligence briefings? Were these Soviet agents planning to make off with other closely guarded technological treasures? Hand in hand with those questions, another concern burned in Bob's already overheated mind. Was it simply vanity to think that the two of them, a relatively junior supervisor on the SE desk and a head-in-the-clouds codebreaker, could lead the assault against a well-entrenched Moscow Center operation? Would they have the strength of body and mind to get the job done? These misgivings, while natural enough, threatened to boil over into a near panic after Bob tried to rally the Bureau to join him in this quest. Part of the problem, he realized, was of his own making. He was bound by his promise to the ASA not to reveal that the KGB ciphers had been cracked. Yet, even with that restriction, he could not grasp why his superiors did not appreciate the worth of the work very much. The bosses, he'd recall with despair, believed little would come of the work and the research. And while he had written the requisite memo to the director and other top officials, giving a more revelatory glimpse into the extent of Meredith's accomplishments, it, too, had elicited not a ripple. No word of encouragement made its way down from the fifth floor. Bob was mystified. The Bureau's complacency was not just bewildering, but also, his every professional instinct shouted, dangerous. Context has been recovered to suggest a possible link between Enormos and wartime nuclear fission research. Yet before he had time to brood, Meredith summoned him. The codebreaker knew better than to say too much over the phone, and anyway, by now that sort of directness was unnecessary between the two friends. Bob only had to hear the animated tone of Meredith's voice, and he immediately understood, he'd later explain, that a sense of urgency and importance had suddenly taken hold of their hunt. 18. We might have an active spy on our hands, Bob decided. Not much more than an hour had passed since he had received Meredith's call, but it had been an hour that had raced away as if it were an instant. One moment he was driving pell-mell through the D.C. traffic, the next he was hurrying across the Arlington Hall campus in a walk that was near enough to a run as to attract curious stares. And then, as soon as he'd entered the gloomy room, Meredith, for once rising from his desk in greeting, had handed over the deciphered cable. And now Bob had just finished his reading. Still clutching the thin page in his hand, he let a single operational thought sink in. There was at last the possibility of a living, breathing target in his sights. Yet despite his excitement, Bob chose to store that intelligence in the back of his mind for now. He needed, he realized, to get a firmer grasp on the entire puzzle. With the dispassionate scrutiny of a veteran counterintelligence analyst, he held the page up to his glasses and started to reread the message that had been sent more than 3 years before, on July 26, 1944, with a slow and deliberate concentration. "To Victor," it began. In July, Antenna was sent by the firm for 10 days to work in Carthage. Bob now paused. It was important to get all the working parts clear before going any further. Victor, Meredith had previously deduced, was the cover name of Pavel Fitton, the spymaster who pulled all the strings in the Foreign Intelligence Division at Moscow Center, or, as the cable put it, the firm. And Carthage, as in Carthage must be destroyed, was the KGB's cover name for Washington. But Antenna? Who was he, or she, for that matter? All Bob knew, again thanks to Meredith, was that the center, as part of its routine security procedures, had recently changed that cover name. Antenna had been rechristened as Liberal. Other than that, Bob had no clue, and so he decided to put the problem aside for the time being and continue reading. There he, Antenna Liberal, visited his school friend Max Elitcher, who works in the Bureau of Standards as head of the fire control section for warships. He has access to extremely valuable materials on guns. Indeed he must, Bob thought. No KGB hood would dare to embellish in a cable to his no-nonsense boss. And Bob pondered something else. Elitcher's name had been sent en clair. His identity was not hidden behind a code name, which meant he was not working for the Soviets, at least not at the time the cable had been sent. Bob resumed his reading. There was a summary of Elitcher's education. He had a degree from the electrotechnical department at New York City College. Now Bob's mind flitted back to the beginning of the cable. Since Antenna Liberal was a school friend, this might prove to be helpful in identifying him. Filing that away, he continued. Elitcher entered the fellow countryman's organization after finishing his studies. And all at once Bob's heart sank. The fellow countryman's organization, according to Meredith's exhaustive report on cover names, was KGB speak for the Communist Party. At the very least, the stage was set for a potential national security disaster. A card-carrying party member had access to military secrets. Plowing on, he read some details about Elitcher's wife, a fellow countryman, who worked, he discovered with one more stab of dismay, at the War Department. Yet what followed struck Bob as even more ominous. Max Elitcher is an excellent amateur photographer and has all the necessary equipment for taking photographs. In other words, Bob realized, Elitcher had the makings of a fully operational spy. All, though, was not yet lost. The cable's concluding sentence offered a small hope. "Please check Elitcher and communicate your thoughts on his clearance." So this message, Bob noted with some solace, had simply initiated the vetting process. It informed the center that the New York residentura had a potential recruit and wanted to get permission before attempting to reel him in. But there was no confirmation that Elitcher, fellow countryman or not, had agreed to betray his country. And with that, the cable came to an end. Bob now focused his full attention on Meredith. Was the FBI man looking for help? The assistance of his friend's invaluable mind in formulating a tactical strategy to grapple with this new information? Or was he using Meredith as a sounding board, trying to bring clarity to his own meandering and alarmed thoughts by speaking them aloud? Bob never shared his motivations. The record that exists is simply cool testimony to this moment when Bob, as if a commander briefing his troops on the upcoming mission, enumerated what must be done. "First, we needed to know," Bob would recall of this charged occasion, whether Elitcher had ever agreed to work for the KGB. Second, if he had been recruited, whether he was still active. And third, whether we could identify the person who had tried, successfully or unsuccessfully, to recruit Elitcher. It was this final challenge, pinning a name and face on the Moscow Center talent spotter working under the cover name Antenna Liberal, that held the promise of real gold. This last was the most important objective, he'd explain with the unfailing wisdom of hindsight, because the recruiter might lead us to others in a network. But even at the time, working only on instinct, he was driven by the possibility that this network would somehow be tied to the unsettling words that kept seizing up inside him. A possible link between Enormos and wartime nuclear fission research. The operational goals laid out, Bob was ready to take charge. At this challenging juncture, he realized only too well that all his big questions remained to be answered. And another reason for pessimism. Every field man knows that making an airtight espionage case is often as much a matter of luck as of diligence. The SE desk was scattered with the carcasses of abandoned investigations. Here, the legal hurdles would be even higher. The deciphered cables couldn't be introduced as evidence in a courtroom. They were such a closely kept secret that even President Truman had no inkling that the Russians' mail was being read. Still, when Bob left Meredith that afternoon, he felt like a hunter who finally had caught the scent of his prey. There was a Soviet network out there, a ring of spies coordinated by a talent spotter, quite possibly an American, codenamed Antenna Liberal, who had graduated from New York's City College. Bob drove back to headquarters with the deciphered cable in his suit jacket pocket, close to his heart. But the sparse cable could only hint at the furtive war that was being waged in the shadows. The New York residentura had been, as Bob and Meredith had increasingly come to suspect, a busy nest of spies. Operating simultaneously on several fronts, the KGB had successfully penetrated the atom bomb project, while also running an ongoing network of well-placed agents who were making off with bundles of technological and scientific secrets. Liberal, just as Bob's gut had suggested, was the linchpin of this secondary ring. Liberal's recruitment had been a cautious dance of veils straight out of the Moscow Center handbook. First, a friend from his student labor movement days, who also was an occasional talent spotter for Soviet intelligence, had, as if it were the most natural of occurrences, introduced him to a KGB field man working out of the consulate in Manhattan under diplomatic cover. Next, this professional, not pushing, just having a casual talk, yet all the while discreetly taking the potential recruit's pulse, discovered that the prospect was not only a passionate supporter of the Soviet experiment, but also worked for the Army Signal Corps. When that tantalizing information was shared with the New York station, Kvasnikov, the KGB desk man running the XY line, as the operation aimed at both atomic and technological secrets was known at the center, was swiftly brought in. It was Kvasnikov, as perceptive as he was cautious, who gave the orders to slip off the final veil. The approach to the spy who would be codenamed Liberal was made during the Labor Day rally in Central Park in 1942. 50,000 people jammed the park on a sunny afternoon, and in the midst of this crowd, standing shoulder to shoulder in solidarity with workers everywhere, was a comradely trio, the potential recruit, his friend from their shared labor movement days, and his new buddy, the talkative Soviet diplomat. And with a serendipity that couldn't have fooled anyone, who should bump into them but the diplomat's good friend, Henry, who happened to be another Russian national. No sooner had Henry and the targeted recruit started talking that the other two men, one the original talent spotter, the other the Soviet diplomat, hewing to the prearranged script, exited. Henry and his new friend went out for lunch that afternoon. The unbreakable rule is that